Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room is Jack Evert and his topic, Psychiatry and Spirituality Overview. So let's listen in on Jack.
I think what I'll do is move between psychiatry and spirituality, and then I'll talk about the common areas last, where some of the things overlap. I think, you know, one of the differences is the medical model is basically designed to respond to a disease. So it's like there's something wrong and it needs to be fixed. So there's this definite idea that whatever's happening right now needs to be changed right now, and that there is a better place for that person to be. So when you think about the disease, you can imagine some of the urgency that goes into the treatment, for example, and some of the clarity about the response. I think when you think about spirituality, we're really thinking more about God's relationship to us. Do we understand the nature of that relationship? Do we celebrate that? Is there ways in which we're distorting that relationship with God, and is that somehow complicating our life? So the whole idea of spirituality is really revolved around the relationship with God. So you can see just kind of point of entry. The end product, so to speak, is very different in some ways. Psychiatry has a model for diagnosis, which is based on experience in a way, and it's based on logic, and it's based on statistical kinds of experiences with people who had mental illness. The first attempts to come up with some statistical manual to understand mental illness were related to institutions, mental hospitals. And then later, when psychiatry got involved in the service, then they were able to use soldiers, and then it kind of expanded into other institutions and clinics. So the more and more experience that physicians had with people who had particular illnesses, the more they were able to characterize and categorize and catalog certain characteristics related to certain diseases. But the whole idea in some ways is that to be objective about that. So they're not looking at each particular situation, they're really kind of looking at statistical studies. So for example, if you were to look in their manual where diagnoses are determined, what you would find is different areas in which they look. So kind of the way I describe it is they kind of look throughout your whole life and they look throughout your history. So for example, if you came to me and said, I just lost my job and I'm seriously depressed, and I can't believe that I'm so upset about this job because I didn't really like it that much. I have another opportunity, but I'm depressed nevertheless. A psychiatrist would probably ask several questions related to, have you ever felt this way before? And you might say, well, my first time I felt like this was when I was in junior high. And then I felt this way when I graduated from high school. And then I had another episode when my father died. And in other words, that there is a history of depressive episodes. And the physician might ask, has your diet changed? You know, have you lost weight? Do you sleep? Have you been hospitalized for anything else? So in other words, all of a sudden it's not just a job, a job situation. All of a sudden there starts to be a broader sweep throughout your life historically, and also through other parts parts of your life. What's very confusing is people who don't understand that look at somebody who's lost their job and says, hey, they got another job, they got severance package, you know, what are they depressed about? Because we wouldn't know the history. We wouldn't know any other physical symptoms that might be presenting themselves. So psychiatry has much kind of a broader sweep, and I think makes a significant contribution in that way, because it's very easy for us to be very kind of narrow in our focus in trying to understand things. But the other part of it is, because they're trying to be objective, they don't, a relationship isn't required. So in other words, they're really asking questions. And so it's not uncommon for people to come out of a psychiatrist's office saying, boy, you know, they don't care about me, I didn't feel any warmth from this person. How can they say that I'm dealing with depression and describe this medication when, you know, they only see me for 20 minutes and they're not going to see me again for another month? You know, why should I be putting my health in their hands? And a lot of it has to do with the way that the diagnostic model is set up in terms of information for them to decide what it is that you might need to do. The other thing that's difficult, I think, is the diagnostic approach is based on the assumption that you want to change or that you would benefit from a change. And this is a way of bringing about the change. Some people hear it as a self-worth question or a statement about who you are or how you are. And I think then that misrepresents what the purpose of the diagnostic model is. So it's kind of like saying, you want to get into this building. Well, you got to find out where the door is. You don't want to just bust through the wall. You want to find out where the door is based on experience, and how do we walk through that door efficiently to get into the building in the best way. To me, that's a diagnosis. It tells you, by looking at the description of the symptoms, it tells you where to enter, how to get into the situation efficiently. So it's not a statement about who you are or how you are, but it's really a doorway that people have been successful in walking through to get into your life to facilitate a change and impact what's going on in your body. The other thing is, it really is a physiological dynamic that they're looking at. So, once again, there's some assumptions about your body chemistry. Your brain basically is nerves and works on a kind of a electrochemical process. So they're really looking at a physical dynamic that they're hoping to impact through medication. One thing that's hard about the brain is that the brain is an organ like any other organ in your body. Things that you would tolerate medically in terms of the treatment of your organ or your liver or your lungs, you would put up with the side effects related to that. But the problem is, when you're dealing with the brain, the side effects to that kind of treatment are much more upsetting, much more confusing. So in some severe cases, you might have a temporary loss of memory, or you might be a little bit more euphoric than normal, you might say. In other words, there's some, like I said, the side effects of the medication when it's related to your brain versus some other organ are much more confusing. In fact, one of the major reasons that people quit taking their medication is because of the side effects. That, you know, they're hearing voices, for example, they take the medication, they quit hearing voices, but they still have dry mouth, or they still have a slight tremor, or they still have some other side effect of the medication. And so they say, well, I'm not hearing voices anymore, so I'll quit taking the medication with the idea of getting rid of the side effects. And then gradually the illness comes back. Because we're dealing with chronic illnesses. In fact, most of the time we shy away from talking about mental health because there isn't any health, so to speak, in the traditional sense of the word. Because these are illnesses that people will have to live with their, you know, possibly their whole lives. So the idea of mental health kind of implies that there is some solution out there.
All of psychiatry isn't just medicine, like prescribing medicine, right? But it sounds like that's what you just, like that's the only...
Well, some psychiatrists are also psychotherapists and practice psychotherapy. And then they kind of decide whether to use medication or not.
But is that the general thing? Is if you walk in the door and say, help, that you would first of all say, okay, here's your prescription. That's kind of the way I hear it, too.
Yeah, well, kind of I think they would be listening for that, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think the psychiatrist, I think.
There's a real difference between psychiatry and psychology, then.
Oh, yes.
You got to know which door to go into, then.
Well, a psychologist isn't a physician and isn't licensed to prescribe medication. So they're not listening for issues related to your body chemistry.
I know the trend now is to more hand-in-hand the therapy with the medication.
Right. Yeah, I'm just outlining how the psychiatrist's role, basically, and certainly these are just generalizations to facilitate discussion. I mean, there are certainly psychiatrists who are psychotherapists and use very little medication. There are some psychiatrists that are total medication and do no psychotherapy. Basically, in our hospital system, you're put into the hospital in part to monitor your medication to make sure that the symptoms fall within the acceptable range, and at the same time you receive some treatment. So that, according to the studies that have been done, the best combination is therapy and medication. So those two working together are the most successful. The model that I hold up, because more people understand it, is related to alcoholism. That basically, according to the big book, alcoholism is an allergy to alcohol and a worldview. So what we've discovered is when you put alcohol in your system, if you're alcoholic, your body chemistry breaks down the alcohol in a way that's different than other person who may not have the disease. Fortunately, with alcoholism, we know that the way to stem that is to withhold the addition of alcohol. So it's somewhat like being a diabetic. You know that your body chemistry does something with the sugar, so you manage your diet. The problem with mental illness is it's not so much withholding something, it's adding something. So in other words, that there's some kind of imbalance. So then to try to figure out how much to add in order to restore the balance. But in addition to the physical piece of it, there's the world view that contributes to it. And so, for example, if you're inclined by your nature to not be trusting and to be somewhat pessimistic, you can still hold a job, you can still get your rest, you can still get along with people. You know, they may kind of chalk you up as to being pessimistic and whatever. But if you have a disease that overlaps that, then that particular worldview could then contribute to the depression. It could make it harder to get unstuck. Another analogy might be to look at heart disease. If you take care of yourself, your heart may, you know, work until you're, you know, 80, 85, or 90, or however. If you don't take care of yourself, maybe you'll have heart problems when you're 65 or 70. But if you have heart disease, you might have heart problems when you're 45 or 47, irregardless of your health. You know, it may help you to have a good diet and to manage your stress, but if you have heart disease, then it's a difficult battle. So just like heart disease, where things are on a spectrum, and we know that your diet, your stress, your lifestyle can impact how you combat heart disease, it's the same way with mental illness, that your worldview, your attitude can combat this particular disease and improve your chances for resolution, but there isn't a one-to-one correlation, okay? It's not that somebody was pessimistic for 10 years in a row and came down with major depression. You know, there isn't that kind of correlation. Okay, is this helpful? Okay. When I think about spirituality, part of what we're doing when we talk about spirituality has more to do with discernment than diagnosis. So in other words, we're not looking at statistical evidence about how people deal with these particular problems and the way to get out of it. Most of us that do spiritual direction kind of go on our experience, our intuition, maybe our knowledge, but not in a statistical or some might even say logical sense. We're assuming that there's a relationship involved. You know, we're assuming that people are people of faith and that they have a relationship with God. We're assuming that if we're pastors doing it, we're assuming that they're investing in some authority in our office, and that they're looking for spiritual direction from us who've been set aside by the community. The other thing around discernment is, at least in my mind, I think about meaning. You know, what meaning are people putting to these experiences? So I don't know if I'm really expecting them to change. Sometimes when we have a different meaning to certain experiences that we've had, that may change our behavior. But I'm not sure that when I see somebody walking in, I don't say, I want them to be different than they are. You know, that's the goal of this particular session. It may end up being that. You know, it may end up facilitating change, but that's not high on the agenda. Psychiatry tends to, at least in terms of hospitalization, is thinking somewhat about protection, particularly when you're dealing with some mental illnesses. And, you know, I'm working there a lot these days. All the doors are locked, so it's a very interesting experience for people to come in constantly locked doors. So there's much more of a protection kind of theme in psychiatry. You know, they'll take people to court to get authority to administer medication if they feel that whatever the illness is, they'd end up being harmful to themselves or others. So there's much more of a strong theme in psychiatry around that is kind of foreign to our way of being, a little bit as a Christian community, I think. Although I think we do raise issues about justice. So part of it was interesting when they put me in a category here, speaking on mental illness, the issue was justice. So what are the justice issues for people impacted by mental illness? And I can spin off themes on that related to housing, related to stigma, things that are, you know, we might consider justice issues in our tradition. Psychiatry is pretty concrete in terms of healing or correction of the illness. If it can't be cured, for example, if it's related to hearing voices, well, then not hearing voices. So you think about, you know, a person comes in, presents these symptoms, and then the symptoms are treated and ceased. I think when I work with people, my concern is that they understand that they're more than this particular illness. This isn't the whole picture of who they are. Part of what happens if you work in a hospital is you realize that people really start to relate to you by your illness. I mean, in the general hospital, we'd say, oh, it's the kidney problem in room 232, or it's the, you know, the new heart person who just came out of surgery. So, you know, we start to relate to people in our language related to their illness. And it certainly is not meant to be disrespectful. It's just, like I said, when you're in-house, that's just kind of the way we end up talking about people. And so I think it's very helpful for the chaplain, and I think a very legitimate role, to remind the staff when that becomes a problem, you know, that they're more than this particular illness. And then the other problem is that people have a history. In other words, they had lives before they got sick, and they'll have lives after they get better. And generally, clergy and other people in Christian communities are better at kind of seeing the full range of a person rather than this particular time in their life, you know, when they're dealing with an illness. Psychiatry is invested in prevention. Once again, I'm going back to a heart transplant kind of issue, but there's some question with heart transplant, for example, is the person have a healthy enough lifestyle to warrant the investment in terms of a new heart? More and more discussions about that, if the person is self-destructive, does medicine want to spend $100,000 on doing a heart transplant, and this person has other kind of habits that are problematic. So part of the emphasis in the medical model is to prevent reoccurrence. So one of the new kind of achievements is a way of dispensing medicine, and I'd need to read more about it, but basically you could come in and take a shot and it would last for a month, rather than trying to remember to take your pills every day. And so some of that is really more preventive in its kind of focus. I think in spirituality, we're not thinking so much about prevention as much as we are kind of moving people to service, moving people to kind of take care of themselves. At least I'm not thinking about, geez, I don't want you to have any more problems in your life. You know, I kind of, there's an assumption that if you get involved in helping other people, that some of those problems might disappear. If you learn to take care of yourself, not so much concerned about others, but finding the balance between service to others and self-care, then that will help you. So we're I think, interested in moving people to service of others and also learning how to take care of themselves, treating their body as a temple and kind of affirming that part of it. The areas that I kind of see as some commonality, I kind of like the idea of sanctuary. I tend to look at our hospital as a sanctuary, a place to go. I think the Christian tradition has an understanding sanctuary of safety where people can go and sort things out, where they're kind of protected from pressures of the outside world, where they can get some help, get some restoration. And I see hospitalization as a sanctuary. I see it as a timeout. You know, people can leave their jobs but go back. People can, I want to say, suspend their relationships, go back. I think there's a lot of common ground when we talk about sanctuary.
Well, there's so much stigma attached to being hospitalized.
Right.
As opposed to, I mean, I like the way you talk about that, uh-huh. And I would try to encourage someone in that way, but, yeah. You know, being hospitalized, you come back into society, people don't think, oh, how pleasant for that person that they had a good sanctuary, a good time
right.
away.
Right.
They think, oh my God, this person's, you know,
right.
had to be hospitalized.
Don't
right.
trust them with a car keys.
Yeah, right. You know, I don't want to sit next to me in the office anymore.
Right. But see, that's why I, you know, part of my job at the hospital is to begin to reframe these issues in a way that lessens the stigma. So, you know, putting out the concept of sanctuary is an opportunity for the church to begin to look at hospitalization in a different way and to think about, well, what are some of the commonalities? And don't all of us, I mean, is it that unrealistic that many of us would need sanctuary in our life journey? I mean, is that symptomatic of a defect of character or something like that? It's not. It's the nature of life. And I think that's why the sanctuary concept is there, is because the world flows in such a way that some people need to step out of it in order to begin to sort some things out.
Like Holden.
Like Holden, exactly. Yeah. The other thing is, you know, what I do at the center is, I guess, what I call practicing the presence of God. In other words, I think we have tended to categorize things ourselves in order to talk about what we have to contribute. And so I assume that God is a part of the hospitalization process. And so my assumption in terms of when we pray together or gather together as a group, it's that God's a part of this particular process. So while it's interesting for us to talk about the difference between spirituality and psychiatry, I do not feel good at all about the implication that somehow God wouldn't be a part of the healing process. You know, that the distinctions might be helpful in terms of understanding our part and what we contribute, but I think the larger, I want to say, responsibility of the church is to keep focused on the promise that God was going to be with us. It didn't, you know, God didn't say, you know, I'll be with you when there's a pastor there, or I'll be with you when there's somebody from your church there, or, you know, it's not that kind of promise. And that somehow I think we have to keep that to the forefront, and we have to help other people keep that to the forefront. It just makes me ill when people call the hospital and they say, well, are you a Christian hospital? And, you know, this implication that there's something that has to be added in order to be Christian, and there may be some contribution that would be good, but does the absence of that mean that somehow God's not present in this process?
But there's often a projection onto the medical person as a healer from God, and as that God isn't my God, or if that person doesn't have a stance that I can, you know, trust, mm-hmm. then there is a conflict in the mind of the person.
Uh-huh. Well, I think you have to trust the person that you're working with, and you have the opportunity, fortunately, in this country, to be a psychiatrist. And I wouldn't want to take that choice away from people. But I think from our point of view, in terms of when we're talking about things, I think that we could educate people or help people understand that more with more clarity God's promise in terms of being with us And like I said, we can choose any psychiatrist we want to be with, but would we deprive ourselves from medical care because this person wasn't a Christian, for example, or maybe wasn't very active? I mean, would you ask that about your heart surgeon or your, you know, person working on your kidney? I mean, so.
It's kind of an interesting question. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I think that specifically there's a task of how do people understand that God's presence is very much alive, even if the individual, you know, medical person doesn't bring that to bear.
Right.
Because the projection really is upon the person very often.
Mm-hmm.
There's a transference.
Right. I'm going to move through these other categories, and then we can come back and visit. Because I'm thinking maybe we can pass the mic around so people can hear the questions, or I can repeat the questions too for the taping. The whole idea of meaning, I think, is a growing edge, because right now there's been a lot of research done that basically says, when you come to some meaning of events that happen to you, you get healthier. So in other words, I think we can kind of support this statistically and scientifically. In other words, we can support the issue of helping people find meaning in ways that is very concrete in terms of their health. So we can say it brings about a change in ways that I think psychiatry will at some point begin to welcome. We've been kicking around a little bit the whole idea of priesthood of all believers, and whether, once again, how we draw this circle. One of the things that I've been, I don't say impressed with, but aware of in terms of the nature of prejudice, it's kind of like any time we have seven people and we draw a circle and only six of them are in it and one is out, I think we have to, that needs to be a red flag for us. I mean, we have to say, now why is this happening? Are we rationalizing this in order to affirm something about ourselves? And I think in some ways we've drawn that circle around psychiatry. And whether psychiatry has a particular healthy perspective towards us, I don't think needs to be our concern at this point in terms of how we speak about them. And I'll come back and talk about, you know, their issues with us. But
it's us.
Us being church folks or clergy. Mm-hmm. Thank you. But I think when you hear people drawing circles, like I said, and putting people on the outside of that, I think that warrants us doing some reflection. I've already talked a little bit about the allergy and the worldview. Part of the reason I put that up there again is because I think it's probably healthier for us to view spirituality in this area as a combination. In other words, we so much want to integrate things. So much want to get it into one category that psychiatry should cover all these bases or spirituality should cover all these bases, and if you really were empowered by God, you wouldn't need medication or hospitalization. And I think it could be very good for us to give up the search for the all-encompassing perspective and begin to understand a complementary perspective. And then finally, the one I put down there is a nice little slogan I'm beginning to love. I call it fear-based religious norms. That part of what happens is people will often use religious norms to support their illness. And I think it's up to us to discern that the religious norms are really based on fear. They're not based on hope.
For example?
For example, people might say, if I work with somebody who's not a Christian, I might go to hell. there's the fear in there, okay? So it's, you know, they're not saying the hope might be, that God will provide someone to support me. And the hopefulness might be, if this is the only resource and they're not a believer, that God would still work with this particular believer. The fear would say, I could make a wrong decision here. I could be punished for a wrong decision. Or we might say, instead of saying love your neighbor as yourself, we might just say love your neighbor. And we might say, if you don't love your neighbor, then the fear is I'm not really a Christian. And so all of a sudden, fear begins to distort religious norms and values in ways that are not, well, they're not a good witness for one thing, and they aren't helpful for the other. And so I think what psychiatry has done is basically said religion is a problem. You know, religion is a symptom of an illness. And we've kind of heard that as, well, they don't, you know, they don't like religion. They don't think it's healthy. And basically what they're seeing is a lot of fear-based religious norms, and they're not discerning the difference between hope and fear. They're just hearing the language. You know, they're just hearing all the religious descriptions. And so they hear this person who's compulsively involved in all these activities and not taking care of themselves, and they're saying, this is my Christian duty to do this. You know, this is what we're supposed to do. Well, you know, how much are we contributing then when we don't challenge those particular fear-based religious norms? When we don't hold up the commandments being love your neighbor as yourself? And is there not a balance that's called for? And do we just let people make these extreme statements that we know are a distortion of the gospel? And then just kind of let that, you know, whiz right by us, you know, without either a correction or at least, if we're invited into their recovery process, and engaging them about that, those particular norms. So I think we're not using our theological training, if we're clergy, or our education in terms of lay people, to really think with much more clarity about things that people call, you know, religious values. Because in some ways they are contributing to the illness. You know, they're actually preventing things from getting better, and that's sad, you know, when that's the case. Okay, I just whizzed through all this, and I appreciate you being patient, you know, while I kind of set out an overview. But what I'd like to do is to open it now more for a discussion, and anything that you'd like to have for clarification, you know, have me talk more about something in order to understand it better, or to engage me or some of these ideas or each other about this.
One of the things I was just going to offer to that sense of balance in this Christian, non-Christian discussion is the danger in spirituality in ignoring the objective, as if facts are somehow different if the person is or is not a believer. I mean, I hear some of that. I work in education and work next door to a Lutheran liberal arts college that where the, you know, there's a lot of discussion about Christian teaching. And I sometimes throw in front of people that I don't want to undermine that or its value at all, but if I'm going to have surgery, it's real important to me not only that the surgeon has said his prayers, but that he studied his anatomy. And, you know, that he knows what to cut. And so I think, you know, this intuition relationship stuff is vitally important, but also very dangerous if it ignores reality and how that some of those facts are there.
I just think it's so much more, I mean, a heart surgeon is an interesting topic, you know, to think about that. But I think it's so much more tricky when it comes to psychiatry or psychology, because the spirit, you know, my heart, I guess I really, you know, I know that all that stuff is connected, but I feel like talking about the meaning and emotions, relationships in my life, that's so hard to separate. If a person didn't at least respect my, how can I talk about my life without talking about my faith? Mm-hmm. How could I do that? And to find someone who poo-poos that, or who thinks that the church is part of my problem, or that my belief in God is part of my sickness, mm-hmm. is really problematic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like counselors that I've worked with, I've been very grateful for their, you know, if not a Christian, at least respect for that, and not thinking that that's part of what is debilitating me, and helping me, like you said, to clarify and discern what might be troubling me, which is different than working on my liver, you know?
Yeah.
They're working on my soul, you know, and helping me to work on that. And so knowledge is not just purely knowledge in that way. You know, somebody could be really well educated in terms of hormonal levels and whatever, you know, chemicals are out of balance in my system, but if they don't be able to see me in the whole way that I see myself, that's...
Although I would push that to say that kind of integration becomes then really important for the person who might work with my lungs. Spirit and breath are the same word biblically. I have a friend who goes to the dentist and says, if you're going to stick your fingers in my mouth, I need to know you. And her first appointment is to establish a relationship that there is more of that involved in all these other parts of our bodies than I think we sometimes give credence to. So yes, it's true of the spirit, but it's very true.
And the idea that someone gets to know you, knows your soul, I mean, I think there's a lot of training that goes into learning how to do that.
Oh, certainly.
You know, so that it's not, I would be very, I mean, I've sat around with members of the church community that I'm in and tried to be therapists to me, and I don't, they're spiritually very accepting and warm and caring, but they don't have the training, and they can injure me or other people, or I can injure other people that way.
I think where it gets difficult in terms of this particular issue has to do with whether it's the decision to withhold treatment or not. So, in other words, it's more apt that a person may say, I'm not going to see a psychiatrist because they don't, you know, they think my religion's going to be a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, I might say, well, that would be sad, or that would be upsetting, but you need to see a doctor. Right. You know, I mean, at some point, to make a one-to-one correlation between whether to receive treatment and a person's attitude, I think is what we need to separate out and to acknowledge. Yeah, it would be good if they could do that, and it would help. But if it's the occasion to withhold treatment, then that complicates, I want to say, the other person's responsibility, because there's probably other people that are being impacted by his or her disease as well as their own body. And, you know, and so I think that that's part of what we would want people to leave with is to say, yeah, it could be better, but you know, to withhold treatment then is enabling the disease in a way.
I think that there has to be a better relationship built between the secular and the religious, that both are needed and both have their place, and that since we are a whole person, that we need to be looked at and dealt with as whole people, and that there is too often a sense that that when you are with one or when you are with the other, that you are in a sense cut in half. Mm-hmm. That I am with a pastor now, I may only talk about God, I may only talk about this, you know, my liver is hurting, I have a broken leg, but I can only speak of the spiritual. And when I am with my secular counselor, you know, my heart is hurting, my spirit is hurting, who I am is in need, but all I can talk about is my leg. You know, and that we need to bring the two together because people are whole people, and that building the relationship between the secular and the religious so that there is more of a respect between the two in what is offered, so that as a part or a member of the secular, I can offer my knowledge and what needs to happen for healing to take place, with an understanding of what my limitations are, so that I can also say that or call on the help from the religious, so that the person who is receiving the help is treated as a whole person. Or if I am a part of the religious, to offer the spiritual needs and the healing, and to say, and with this, to call on the help. The people are all, you know, we're in a corporation of everything. We have to all, we carry it all with us, our secular needs and our spiritual needs.
Like I said, the part that I guess I want to more directly challenge in some ways, because we live in a fragmented world, and people, I think, need to make choices based on that fragmentation. And the holistic approach, I just don't think it's going to happen. I mean, part of what's happening, being quite realistic, is with the changes in the medical system, more and more pressure in terms of cost cutting and managed care. You know, I think that whether chaplains are going to be in hospitals in the future, I think is a question. Whether they're going to be in there in the numbers that people have come to expect is questionable. And whether people are even going to be hospitalized long enough for people to visit them. I mean, it may take, you know, 2 days for your pastor to find out that somebody's in the hospital and they're going to be gone. So some of the care in some ways is going to be outside of out of the hospital per se. So while on one hand I would like that kind of integration, I can't see it coming in the future realistically. You know, whether a church hires a psychiatrist or works with a psychiatrist to bring the integration into the congregational model, you know, maybe that's something we could feel more in charge of. But right now, medically, there's dramatic changes, you know, moving. And some of it's related to what people are willing to pay for. You know, I mean, if you want to pay for that kind of integration, then I'm sure that
there are movements, though.
Yeah.
And I would take that more as a challenge.
Right.
That in my line of work, which is, I am a domestic violence counselor.
Yeah.
And what I specifically do, which is my highest point of interest, is that I'm the church liaison. So working for a secular agency, it is my job to reach out to the church community to give them a better understanding of who we are and what we do, what our gifts are, and what we have to offer as a secular agency, and what our limitations are and what we need from the church, to create a relationship between the two, saying, you know, this is where our specialty lies, this is what we have to offer, but but these people need more than that. They need you. And vice versa.
Yeah.
The other reaction I have to what you said about fragmentation is the freedom, and a better word, I think, is the power to say that integration is mine. And there's never an external agency, approach, theory, therapist who can integrate it. And some of the beauty of, I guess I'd be interested in where you'd put power. Probably that should
power
be in the common area. Empowerment. You know, some of that empowerment kind of stuff is that, I mean, I can study ecology from a flagrant atheist and learn so much about my faithful belonging to the world and redemption in the world, and because of the power I have to take his or her research and gifts and integrate them. And I mean, the law gospel of that is that there's no, when you want somebody else to do it, they can't, you know, they can give you their gifts, but they can never integrate it.
Well, in any model, I mean, you know, this maybe sounds flippant, it's not meant to be, but my first response is the power and authority is with the patient. And that these particular models are meant to interact with the person. I mean, they're not, you know, they're not abstract, but they're meant to engage the person, affirm their power and authority, so that even though I might treat them as if they're more than their disease, they still need to say, yes, I believe that. You know, they still need to say, that's a word of gospel to me. They still have to believe it. I can't make them believe that. I can act under the assumption that they are more than their illness. And it's the same way with the psychiatrist. I mean, you know, that's why there's some benefit for me on, you know, doing some PR for them related to the diagnostic model and stuff, so that people don't get turned off, so they understand that, you know, this model is meant to empower me to bring about change quickly, efficiently, and it's based on experience. And so that then they can let go of some other very legitimate concerns they might have, but take what the model has to offer, and I want to say let go of the rest, or at least not let it be a deterrent from getting some help. Because I think if, I mean, part of what I see in psychiatry is if psychiatrists treat you as you're more than your illness, they're going to have the same attitude about themselves. They're going to have to say, I'm more than my job as a psychiatrist, and they're going to benefit from that as well. So, I mean, nobody benefits from things being compartmentalized. But right now, that doesn't mean that that particular service, you know, to your body's biochemistry isn't an important service to obtain.
I think the hardest, this is a little bit off, but maybe not necessarily, I think the hardest thing for me, there are some people in my family who need to be on medicine. You know, for depression, and works really great. And so what's the spectrum of, you know, healing that you need in terms of, you know, how to determine what's, you know, certainly there's tests that can be done to see, well, just this level is really off of this thing. But to know, you know, here's, in my mind, it's kind of like, here's psychiatry, and then there's like talking with a friend is here, you know?
Right.
And so how do you make a decision about where to go and who to seek help from? And I'm very fearful of talking with somebody who has the power to prescribe medicine, because I feel like that's, and partly also because of other things, but so I guess I struggle with how to make those decisions and who to trust. When somebody who is a psychiatrist, you know, their first thing might think, well, what prescription could I give that would help this person? And so I guess I kind of look more towards psychologists or counselors who then might say, you know, we've worked on this for 2 years, and gee, I really think it might be good if you went to a doctor, you know, and had them check this, you know.
We always have the power to say, I don't want to take the prescription. Mm-hmm. I'd like to wait and see.
Or to have them explain why it is that they feel that way. The other thing is, you know, I think a person, the best person to prescribe is also the best person to decide that medication's not needed. I mean, so, I mean, kind of with the experience of what helps, you also know that it's not, that this isn't a case where they need medication. And most psychiatrists, frankly, if there's any borderline case where, you know, it's questionable whether they need it or not, generally it's the patient demanding medication that they're more apt to give in and possibly prescribe something when maybe it, you know, maybe it's more on the borderline. I think it would be much more rare that it would be the physician talking somebody into medication when they're more on the edge. It's much more that the patient would come in and say, you know, I'm not sleeping, I need this and such, and, you know, and really kind of put pressure on the, particularly the general physician, you know, that they would meet, who maybe, you know, would know enough about medication but not be quite as discerning. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily assume that you go to a psychiatrist and you get medication. I mean, we're kind of assuming that that's, they're predisposed to do that, but one of the benefits of being objective is that, you know, there's some responsibility there. And that's not to say that, you know, it's like every other profession, that there might not be people that you can trust, but then, like I said, part of what happens is, who do you trust that sends you to the psychiatrist? In other words, you know, there's psychiatrists that I send to people, and people are trusting my judgment, you know, about that. So there is something about networking, you know, to get a good physician, that's just being wise, you know, it's being discerning, you know, to go where some of those other needs can be met.
There is a lot of fear of medication, though.
Yeah.
And as in my pastoral practice, I would say more than I think is helpful.
Yeah.
Where I would say to somebody, if you had a broken leg, would a cast be demeaning?
Right.
You know, a cast gives you support until you heal, and this is a resource for...
Well, that's why clergy has to be educated so much more, it seems to me. I mean, people shouldn't be fearful of going to a pastoral counselor or to a psychologist, because they'll know that they have means of referral. They'll be listening to you say, look, I really don't want to take medication. Okay, let's see what we can do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if, as time goes by, if things don't help, then you can have a referral system and talk about it, continue to talk about it. But it's a sense that clergy is sort of not very well educated. Shrinks, psychiatrists will always prescribe, and a psychologist nobody can afford.
Well, and the sad thing is that sometimes the medication helps and it gets you, you know, to a better place without, I hate to say, without needing a lot of therapy.
Right, right.
You know, the chemical imbalance can distort something.
Yeah.
Or just sheer fatigue. Somebody's not sleeping.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other piece, is how much, like I said, when the medication can help you sleep and help your eating and other things like that. Another thing we haven't really talked much about is physical exercise, too, is real helpful. Go ahead, ma'am.
Well, do they, when you feel better after you've taken medication, how do they know whether you can go off the medication or whether you're going to have to take it forever and ever?
Well, some of it is because of their statistical approach to studies on previous patients. So, in other words, they've done studies to say a person who fits this category of depression, when they've been on medication 6 months and go off. This is what happens when they go, when they've been on it 9 months and they go off. This is what happens. So all of this has been researched out, and there's supporting kind of experience. Part of what happens, I think, is that the categories, because they deal with the categories so much, they have them memorized. And so you don't really realize that they're going through a checklist related to different categories, so that their diagnostic process has what we call five axes. In other words, there's five different kind of areas.